Welcome to the Noblest Insights panel on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today's panel is titled, Can Innovation Survive Budget Cuts? I'm your host, Tom Temin. Our guests today are Jim Zarzycki. He's a Noblest Fellow. Dr. Daniel Gerstein. He is the Deputy Undersecretary of the DHS Science and Technology Directorate. Dr. Timothy Persons, Chief Scientist at the GAO. And Daniel Madrakowski, Program Leader at the Engineering Laboratory at NIST. It's great to have you, gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. And I'd like to start with just a couple of minutes on what we mean by the word innovation in the first place. Jim Zarzycki, why don't you start?
I'd say innovation is the application of the technology to solve a need.
That's pretty simple. Something not too bad. Okay. Dr. Persons, tell us. I mean, from the GAO, you look government-wide, you see all this kind of stuff.
Sure, and GAO's support to the Congress, we often evaluate things in what I would categorize as people, processes, and technology. And certainly I think innovation can apply in that domain, meaning doing something new, whether it be in a process or in a particular technology, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit more.
Okay, and NIST is the agency with all the new publications. Every time there's a turn in technology, is that what amounts to innovation for NIST's point of view?
Innovation for us, we're basically the nation's measurement lab. So we want to use measurement science to get these ideas into a practical, usable item or a technique or a methodology using standards as one measure or a test to basically give everybody a fair baseline when you want to evaluate that innovation. How good is it? Will it do what people promise?
Okay, and of course, DHS has the big job here in terms of protecting the homeland and a lot of emergency response links to those different communities. Innovation means what to DHS when it comes to emergency response?
Well, I mean, let me take it up a little higher and just say that when you talk about innovation in a classical sense, you're talking about basic and applied research and then moving on to things like concept development, integration, engineering, and finally acquisition and fielding. And I think those all still apply, but to the point that one of the panelists made, that today we're looking at innovation in somewhat a different way by saying it's not just the science and the technology, but it's also about what we can do in terms of acquisition support and operational analysis. It's about process enhancements that can lead to better outcomes and gaining efficiency. So all of that comes to innovation. Let me give you one quick example. You know, there's nothing new about a suitcase, and there's nothing new about putting or having wheels on things like chairs. But by taking a suitcase and putting wheels on it, you get innovation. So a pretty easy example. You solved a real-world problem, and now people get through airports much more rapidly.
Okay, I'd like to talk about a little bit of what science is going on in the different agencies directed toward this whole area of emergency response. And why don't we start with you, Dr. Gerstein, since DHS is the big footprint here in emergency response.
Okay, well, we're doing a lot of work. And in fact, I talked about those four categories, technology, acquisition support, process enhancements, and efficiencies. And again, I think the best way to handle this is to talk in terms of some concrete examples. One example is a backboard cover. It's a very simple adaptation, but what we discovered was that we had first responders who were, when they'd pick up a victim, accident victim, they were having cross-contamination on backboards, and so there was a real need. And in response to that need, what occurred was we met with the first responders. They told us what might be of use to them. We developed a light Kevlar covering, a head and neck brace system, and for under $100,000, we were able to develop a capability, get it approved, and now it's available on a GSA schedule. So that gives you some idea of a concrete example. We also have a tool, for example, that allows first responders to break through up to 18 inches of concrete. It used to take them quite a long time. This impact tool, which has just now been fielded with the Fairfax Search and Rescue, is available also on a GSA schedule. So all right. Those are two concrete examples, if you will.
And Mr. Madrakowski from NIST, your specialty is fire and fire control. What are some of the activities that you are directing research at these days?
Again, with support from DHS, S&T, we're looking at standards, a brand new standard for thermal imaging cameras that first responders use, all sorts of sensors and devices, both chemical sensors and radiation sensors for anti-terrorism type practices. the use of robots in many cases to carry these sensors. There's a tremendous amount of work. In fact, right now there's activity going on at Disaster City in Texas where we're evaluating standards and test methods for robots for bomb disposal, for urban search and rescue, and again, anti-terror activities. Protective clothing for first responders, firefighters, police officers in terms of body armor. We do all that sort of work and try to continually improve it to make it more useful and more effective.
And Jim Zarzycki from Noblis, you have kind of an across-the-government look from the work that the company does and your history of that program evaluation. Tell us what you're seeing across some of the agencies.
Well, let me start by just talking a little bit about what Noblis does. So we're a nonprofit organization, and we're a science, technology, and strategy organization. And our clients are the federal agencies almost exclusively. So what we try to do is help our clients solve complex science and systems problems. And so I think typically we do that by coupling domain expertise like ChemBio or biometrics or understanding of networks with excellence in systems engineering, acquisition, program management.
And so systems engineering and program management are the kind of the soft sides of the whole innovation question, but sounds like they're pretty important.
Well, I think they're, as pick up on what Dan said earlier, they're very important because just having the scientific breakthrough really doesn't count as innovation. You've got to be able to take that scientific breakthrough, package it in a way that it satisfies a need, and then be able to get that need essentially to the field, you know, satisfy that need in the field.
And Dr. Persons at GAO, what does the chief scientist do, and what activities have you observed most recently in the whole emergency response area?
Okay, so as the chief scientist, I'm responsible for the scientific integrity of GAO's work and reports. I actually have a colleague, chief technologist, who supports the technology piece as well. So we cover both science and tech across the vast array of GAO work that we do. And at last count, myself and my colleague and our staff were covering something over 100 different jobs that have science and technology components, of which several of them had to do with DHS or things that, for example, NIST is involved in. Let me just echo again, I think there's unanimity here in terms of what Jim just said, the importance of system engineering and process engineering on these things. Innovation must involve that. It's oftentimes not just applying the widget, it's how the widget can help enhance the operational context. And of course, in a post-9/11 world, it's driven a lot of GAO's work in this area. For example, we've done a lot of work in communications technologies in the post-9/11 era. Basically, you think about radio systems that need to be updated. The U.S. Capitol Police or other, what now are DHS components, used to have essentially World War II era radio systems, and we're trying to shift into digital radios. So that sounds simple in principle, radios, but the way they have to interoperate in this complex and dynamic environment that a lot of DHS and other first responders have to operate in is an example of that.
You know, it's safe to say that whole SAFECOM and interoperable radio project work actually predates 9/11. And just looking around the table, I think most of us have been involved in this kind of work before 9/11. Did 9/11 accelerate this whole idea of scientific inquiry and then engineering into emergency response? But actually it predates that. Is that fair way to put it, Dan Madrazowski? Is that a good way to put it, Dan Madrakowski?
Absolutely. NIST first got involved with emergency response in 1904. At the time, we were called the National Bureau of Standards. The Great Baltimore Fire. Baltimore was burning. Many city blocks were burning down. They were bringing fire engines from Washington, D.C. They were putting them on trains in Philadelphia and transporting them down to try to help the Baltimore Fire Department. But they had an interoperability problem in 1904. None of the hoses or the engines could connect to the fire hydrants in the city of Baltimore. And as a result, those engines remained idle and were useless. And basically, people just had to watch Baltimore burn. So as a result of that, that was one of NIST collaborating with the NFPA and Underwriters Laboratory way back in 1904, developed one of the first standards for fire hydrants and the hose fittings and connections. In the 70s, there was a big push After World War II, certainly there's a big push to protect buildings, and that's what a lot of the work was from the early, from 1904 up, to protect buildings from fire. Then in the 70s, with the publication of America's Burning, there was a huge push to begin to protect people from fire. And that's really where an understanding of the toxic chemicals that were developed by fire and other things, to understand how that impacted not only the first responders, but the occupants in their home and what kills them, you know, the toxic gases and the smoke typically, and those sorts of things. Then in the 90s, the push came to really protect first responders and how we could improve, because they've been doing things for the past their tactics and techniques are basically 100 years old. To give you an example, New York City, many of their tactics are based on what they call tenement tactics. Manhattan, you know, around the turn of the century, the last century was 4 to 6 story tenement buildings for the most part, and they had a strategy for ventilating those buildings. As Manhattan grew up to be high rises, now multiple stairwells, very long hallways and whatnot, they were using the same ventilating tactics and basically getting their folks in trouble. With the support of DHS and the Assistance to Firefighter Grants Program, we worked with FDNY. The focus was really on wind-driven fires and structures, but then it turned out to basically apply to everybody across the country for just high-rise fires and improve their tactics and tools.
All right, so this goes back more than a century, and we are going to continue on that vein. You're listening to the panel, Can Innovation Survive Budget Cuts, here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. We'll return in just a moment.
When the stakes are high, government agencies turn to Noblis to solve some of their toughest challenges in program management, acquisitions, systems engineering, and science and technology. By combining fresh perspectives, unparalleled subject matter expertise, and industry best practices, Noblis is creating new processes and business models that improve operational performance, reduce program risk, and help clients achieve their missions faster. As experts in science, technology, and strategy, with advisory services in national and homeland security, transportation, healthcare, environmental sustainability, and enterprise transformation, Noblis excels at turning ideas into innovations that speed the delivery of services and business solutions. To find out more about Noblis, go to noblis.org. That's Noblis.org.
Welcome back to the Noblis panel. Can innovation survive budget cuts, here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM? I'm your host, Tom Temin. Our participants today are Jim Zarzycki. He's a Noblis fellow. Dr. Daniel Gerstein, Deputy Undersecretary of the DHS Science and Technology Directorate. Daniel Madrakowski, Program Leader at the Engineering Laboratory of NIST. And Dr. Timothy Persons, Chief Scientist at GAO. And of course, budget cuts is part of the title of our session today, so let's get right to that. It's a very difficult time for the federal government in terms of the budget, and we don't know really where it's going to be headed, except that probably smaller this year than last year. And so what is the process by which innovation and then eventual productization of the innovation can still occur when budgets are really constrained? And why don't we start with you, Dr. Persons from GAO?
Thanks, Tom. I think one of the first things an agency can do is, in terms of the coordination mission, looking across and seeing, are there things that are overlapping with my mission or in a duplicate status? The reason I say this is GAO now has an overlap and duplication mandate for the near term, and we just issued it's been one of our most successful reports. It's on the GAO.gov website. But it's just looking across all the federal programs dealing with this. For example, in the context of first responder support and science and technology therein, we think of the chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear detection series. There's a lot of work going on in Department of Defense, Department of Homeland Security, Department of Energy, the Environmental Protection Agency. Lots of various things. I think one thing a program manager can initially do is just see, are there colleagues out there that are working on this so that I don't have to, you know, reinvent the proverbial wheel on this and incorporate what they're doing into my plan.
Yeah, so lack of duplication becomes a great way to not really harm anything and yet get more out of the money available. And Jim Zarzycki, you have a window into a lot of agencies also, and do you find ways, and as part of your work, trying to maybe say, hey, this guy over at Agency B is helping this person over at Agency C. Maybe you guys can get together and efficiency can ensue.
I think one of the values that Noblis provides to its clients is that ability to integrate across the different agencies. For example, we have a significant biometrics practice. Now, there's work in that area going on in DOD, DHS, FBI, NIST, Department of State, and we're touching all those bases, and we feel it's our responsibility to almost force the collaboration.
So you're putting your fingerprints on all of the biometric activity that's happening across government. And that gets us to Homeland Security. And, of course, you have a larger, greater DHS, if you will, than just the federal department. Tell us how that comes into play in terms of trying to wring efficiency into the research activities directed toward this whole emergency response area.
Well, before talking about efficiencies, I'd just like to give you a little bit of reality, budget reality, so to speak. I mean, we're seeing approximately a 50% reduction in our buying power. That's sort of the bottom line from fiscal year 2010 to the continuing resolution in 2012. And I wouldn't want to tell you that all the missions that we think are important are going to get done. And in fact, at these levels, we believe we are just at the edge of maintaining viability of the DHS S&T mission. So having said that, we are going to stop investing in some very critical capabilities. And I'll let your listeners be the judge. Semi-submersible vehicles and ultralight vehicles. We're not doing any more research on countering those. Real-time detection for biological attack. Domestic IED detection. That's the improvised explosive devices. In terms of first responders, we're having to give up on a program for voice and data interoperability, which is absolutely critical. Another capability for first responders is Virtual USA that has been helping in the floods in the southeast. That's likely to be a budget casualty. Now, that doesn't mean the news is all bad. We actually believe that there is a great deal of work that can and must go on, and we're using new strategies to get at that. One of them, I think, that's very important is this idea that we can no longer afford basic and applied research. And therefore, instead of thinking about big R and big D, research and development, we are thinking about little r and big D. So we are trying to find more late-stage technologies from other organizations that we can adopt, bring into the department, bring to the first responder community that will still assist in accomplishing missions. We're also doing something new called technology foraging. And by that, I mean we are actually looking to have studies and analysis of where other technologies have been used, what else is out there within the community, and then how to adopt those and bring those forward. We are partnering as much as we can. One example, I think a great example, is in the National Biological Analysis and Countermeasure Center, better known as the MBAC, up at Fort Detrick, Maryland. I just have been working on a deal between DOD and the FBI and Department of Homeland Security, whereby this interagency facility would do work for all three departments. So we are trying to maximize, to leverage all of the opportunities that are out there. And the final thing is to look for efficiencies, and we are working hard on that. One example is we just saved TSA about $2.1 million in training costs through improved efficiency. So it doesn't mean that all the news is bad. It just means we really have to take a hard look at how we're doing business and what we can afford.
So finding commonalities and passing the hat even might be one way to get more out of the network of people working in this whole area.
Well, there are so many people working in all these areas. As one panelist pointed out, there are lots of opportunities for collaboration. But, you know, there are no easy answers out there. Some would say, well, Department of Homeland Security, they're working biometrics. Why don't they just go to Department of Defense, who's had great success in Iraq and Afghanistan? You know, unfortunately, the problem is that you cannot just directly import technologies, that they have to go through some sort of harmonization. In DOD, Department of Defense, there is lots of time to train soldiers. In the Department of Homeland Security, there is no time to train anyone. We are an operational entity, and we are on the front line every day. And with that sort of requirement, we do not have the opportunities to do lots of hands-on training. The other thing you'll find is that where DOD can afford a very healthy capability, sometimes the Department of Homeland Security has to think at a much smaller level of funding. And that's something that is not well understood within the community of people who would would recommend that we go to other departments.
And Dan Madrakowski, I wonder how standards can play a part in getting more efficiency to research and development projects. You mentioned fire hose couplings back in 1904. That same effect must apply today also.
The standards development process plays a major role, in part because for example, the National Fire Protection Association consensus standards or the ASTM international standards or standards developed by the Society of Fire Protection Engineers, they bring together stakeholders, they bring together the first responders, they bring together manufacturers and researchers from academia, from private industry, and from government. So that's how we get to interact with all these folks. How do we make this an efficient process? Funding, public-private partnerships. We have a lot of guest researchers at NIST. We have a lot of students, again, with a big interest of training and keeping the future of technology and science in America alive to continue that innovation. So we have a lot of these relationships, grant programs that either come from NIST or other agencies that we always try to keep attuned to and tied into with our other federal partners and work together to push the ball forward.
And Dan Gernstein, you have a good example of a standards.
It's a great example, and it's so good because it involves several of the entities who are actually talking today. But it has to do with the white powder standard. And we have just now put in place a white powder standard, which was developed with NIST, with the Department of Homeland Security, with our FEMA subordinate component. And we all come together to work on this, but this is in response to the 2001 Amerithrax attacks. And we now actually have a standard which first responders can rely on. They now know what to do when you go into a potential contamination. Rather than rush in there and perhaps become a victim yourself, you have certain standards that you will follow.
And Jim Czarzycki, when you try to, as you said earlier, get some agencies to talk to one another where you are aware, but they might not have been aware of the possibility for collaboration and therefore getting some efficiency, how's the reaction to that?
That's usually very positive. I mean, organizations are interested in learning, so there is not pushback about not invented here. That's in my experience. I just wanted to pick up on something that I was very happy to hear Dan say as he talked about budget cuts. He didn't say we're going to stop doing research. Very important that we don't go ahead and eat all of our seed corn. We need to have the adapt-adopt model to push the technology into the field, but we don't want to stop doing some research that'll help us for the future.
And Dr. Persons, you also have this report. In fact, I've read the overlap and duplicative report, and it's something you do every year, and I think you're getting even more elaborate with that report as each year goes by. When agencies are confronted with this information, do they usually say, oh, good idea, we'll get together, maybe combine this, or do they hang on to it?
I think there's a little bit of both in that response. I think there's some acceptance among the agencies. I think the core issue here is collaboration is often easy to conceive of. The coordination, it's often hard to do in terms of the way the system is set up. So there are points of light in terms of this going on. I think Dan just mentioned a very good one on the Amerithrax case, a series of work that we've done. And in fact, have worked closely with DHS on those reports.
And just briefly, when you say white powder standards, what does that mean exactly?
Well, so the white powder standard would be the standards you would use when confronting a potential anthrax event. Anthrax leaves a white powder, it leaves a residue. And so what you would want to do is to cordon off areas and bring in the right experts who are in the proper kit that can go and do what they need to and then protect others around.
Okay.
Right, go ahead. There's a sampling strategy in that. Where if a building's contaminated, is it just one room? Is it the entire building? Has it gotten outside? Containing that risk, assessing, diagnosing it, and then responding accordingly is the issue.
You're listening to the Noblest Panel, Can Innovation Survive Budget Cuts, on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'm Tom Temin, and we'll be right back.
In today's budget-constrained environment, how can government agencies do more with fewer resources? Noblis, a nonprofit science, technology, and strategy organization, is helping solve that problem every day. By combining fresh perspectives, unparalleled subject matter expertise, and industry best practices, Noblis is creating new processes and business models that improve operational performance, reduce program risk, and help clients achieve their missions faster. As experts in science, technology, and strategy, with advisory services in national and homeland security, transportation, healthcare, environmental sustainability, and enterprise transformation, Noblis excels at turning ideas into innovations that speed the delivery of services and business solutions. To find out more about Noblis, go to noblis.org. That's N-O-B-L-I-S.org.
Welcome back to the Noblis Insights panel. Can innovation survive budget cuts here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM? I'm your host, Tom Temin. Our panelists today are Daniel Madrikowski, program leader at the Engineering Laboratory at NIST, Dr. Timothy Persons, chief scientist at GAO, Dr. Daniel Gerstein, deputy undersecretary of the DHS Science and Technology Directorate, and Jim Zarzicki, a Noblis Fellow. You know, we talked about the budget constraints, and that's something everybody in government and at all levels, really, not just federal, but state and local, are living with. But that's a reality, but also there are priorities. So I thought in this segment we would talk about what some of the priorities are that you are absolutely going forward with in the science, technology, research area, and then we can talk about how that will get translated into products and services and contracts down the line. So Dr. Gerstein, why don't we start with DHS?
Okay, great. Well, thanks. Let me start with the Quadrennial Homeland Security Review. It was the first time we've ever done one. It is a powerful document, actually. It provides five overarching missions, and all of those are directly related to first responder requirements. And out of that, what we have done is to derive a set of objectives to improve the safety and effectiveness of the first responder community. So the objectives include, number one, gaining a better understanding of the needs and requirements of the first responders. And we're doing that through a variety of different ways. We have a lab up in New York City that's called the National Urban Security Technology Laboratory, helping to figure out what are the first responder requirements in a major U.S. city. We're also helping the first responders in conducting systems analysis of the work that they do. We have instituted most recently a first responder resource group, which brings in 120 local, state, tribal, and federal practitioners as an advisory body. Our second objective is high impact technologies and knowledge products. I've already talked about some of those with the concrete tool, the backboard cover, the white powdered standard. We have a couple more examples, but I'll save those for another time. We also have advances in interoperability and communications. We're working very hard so that we can share information across the community. Things like our Glancer system, which gives a three-dimensional view, a blue force tracker, if you will, for first responders, firemen, police who would be going into buildings and such. And then finally, increasing access to information. We have a number of products here, including our first responder website, trying to get information out on products that are available, on best practices, on standards. So we're working very hard across the community to ensure that first responders are able to do their jobs.
And Dan Madrikowski at NIST, I know you mentioned that interoperability of communications is a big topic, and also that info access, I think, is something. Give us an idea of the priorities at NIST in the first response area.
Communications are certainly a big one. So we're working on the 700 megahertz testbed, sort of looking ahead to how the spectrum will be divided and how it can be used for first responders, dedicated spectrum for first responders. And again, it's a testbed so that the companies that are making the products will have something to work with and test against. Mass notification. How do you communicate with the public? How do you let the public know that there's an issue? What are the appropriate words to use? What are the appropriate technologies, tweeting or what have you, to really get the word out there and get it out there quickly? Communications among the first responders themselves. One of the challenges for location systems and some of these other new technologies that DHS is working on is getting that signal just out of the building. The frustration that you might have when your cell phone doesn't work. And in many cases, we have things that are that we're encouraging, like a better efficiency, energy efficiency standards, that are, you know, making it harder and harder for the radio signal to penetrate the building to get in and out. So those are some pretty big challenges. Protecting the first responder force with regard to protective clothing, better SCBAs and breathing apparatus, better respirators. Again, many of these things prove themselves to be somewhat weak links in the post-World Trade Center world. And also in just the everyday firefighting, we're seeing things where other pieces of equipment have gotten better, and now the fire service has kind of lost their balance with regard to their protective envelope. Certain things are weaker than others, so we're working on those priorities. And last but not least is tactics. You talked about a systems approach and just getting coordination on a fire ground event, coordination on a terrorist event to make sure people, again, leading back once again to communications, people know what actions are expected, what they should be doing, and to work in a coordinated manner, a safe manner.
And Dr. Persons at GAO, of course, you're always the ones that sound the warning notes as agency activities proceed. What are the risks for agencies as they pursue these different areas in terms of emergency response, research, and development?
I think the theme that GAO has seen throughout, it's very distinct and clear over time, really would be best categorized as acquisition management when you're talking about innovation. I mean, good acquisition management, you have project management, oversight, risk management, developing reliable cost estimates, and so on. But among them, requirements management is oftentimes one of the key things. And within the context of technology and inserting that into operational systems, that gap is often, again, one of those easy to conceive of, oftentimes very hard to do. And among all the broken programs that we've often sort of analyzed and so on, we do find that there's a storyline of relatively immature technology being scheduled for invention, as it were, and being pushed in an immature basis. Large buys are then taken on by a given federal agency. And then when you discover the weaknesses of the technology in the systems engineering concept that we've been talking about, then I think that's often a recipe for disaster, and we see a lot of that at GAO.
And Jim Zarzycki, then how do agencies best overcome that to make sure the requirements are clear and they know the difference between technology and science?
I think it's very interesting that both Tim and Dan both picked up on the requirements issue. And Noblis works across the entire life cycle, so that really goes from requirements all the way through acquisition, and standards is part of that. But the place where I think we may do the most good is in helping with the requirement setting. And it sounds so easy, but it's really not. You have to be able to get in the mind of the customer. You have to be able to translate that into something that the technologist can work with. You need a technical spec. And then you have to be able to carry that all the way through the testing phase and the acquisition phase. So I think we're working hard to help solve that how to do requirements better problem.
And of course, in the contracting world, we have contracting officers, representatives to look at this kind of thing. So that becomes a people issue. Are there a similar analog to those types of representatives to go between the agency requirement and the grantee or contractor doing that work? Do we have the right people in place, as far as you can see, in the federal government, given the budget constraints, to make sure that that translation takes place?
I think federal government has people who are trained in the acquisition area. Sometimes that training doesn't go all the way back to understanding how to generate requirements. Contractor augmentation is an important part of the strategy for federal agencies such as DHS. I mean, in this area, you really would like a person who understands the mission of the client, understands that client need, and also is a technologist, and also has the programmatic smarts, so understand what it takes to actually get it through the acquisition process.
Yeah, I would like to come in on that because I think it's really important. It's not just about the requirements and understanding what is required in the field, but it's also about how to deliver that capability in a cost-effective manner. It's different. You mentioned the term federal. We can help at the federal level by taking in the state and local requirements and providing solutions like with the concrete basher or the backboard cover. But on the other hand, that has to be something that is affordable for the state and local communities. And if it's not, then the best products may not ever get to the hands of the first responder.
And Dr. Persons, a comment?
Right. So I think there's also, you mentioned the contracting officer representative. There's also a formal position in the acquisition sense called the COTAR, the C-O-T-R, the contracting officer technical representative. And I think it goes to what Jim was saying. You really this is a people issue now. Do you have the right competency, the right individual who not only can navigate the federal acquisition regulations, but understands the science and technology, also understands the concept of operations upon which the operators need to, for example, a fireman just wants to have a radio that works. He's not going to care necessarily about trunked digital systems or something. He wants a reliable piece. So oftentimes that particular operator isn't going to be able to elucidate very technical things about the nature of the radio. He just wants it to work. So someone has to bridge that gap and out of the research and development community, putting it into the operator's hands.
And Dan Madrakowski, I wanted to ask you too, as a way of optimizing the resources and network, it would seem that some of that expertise can be obtained in the state and local and commercial sectors along with federal. Is that how it works at NIST in developing standards and looking at new technologies?
Absolutely. Again, working across the board with academia and with private industry, and most importantly with our other federal partners as well, and there's a lot of expertise there. We kind of think that measurements are the bridge. Measurements and standards can serve that purpose to get between the requirements and then the thing that the guy really needs in the street. I just want this to work. And so what's the basis for determining that for him so the firefighter can worry about his job and not worry about whether or not his radio works or what the technology is in the box. He just needs it to work, and he needs it to work reliably.
But it seems like that kind of impetus could be used more carefully in requirements development. Like, what do you mean by work? Maybe ask firemen. Is that something that we should be doing, or asking people that might be dealing with powder?
Absolutely. A great example is the wind-driven fires, where we worked with the Fire Department of New York City. We worked with the Chicago Fire Department, and they had guys that were actually innovating on the ground saying, you know, we had this fire. If we just, and the window broke out, and the wind blew this fire and created it into a blowtorch and killed three of our guys. If we had a piece of plywood we could have dropped in front of that window, we could have stopped this. So that led to the development of some very flexible and easily portable wind control devices, high-rise nozzles, again, that you can use from the floor below so you don't have to sort of go down the barrel of the shotgun, if you will, wondering whether the flame's going to roll over you or not. And it makes them more effective and safer. And it was a great thing with the Assistance to Firefighters grants, because here was technology that was supported in part by DHS and developed. And then these fire departments were able to use the Assistance to Firefighters grants to buy that technology in the form of positive pressure ventilation fans, these high-rise nozzles, and the wind control devices. So it was really a great case study, if you will, of how this could work very efficiently. So within 18 months, FDNY turned around a tradition, basically, that they've been following for 100 years, and through training and new technology, put something new into practice. And now this idea is spreading across the country.
You're listening to the Noblest Insights panel. Can innovation survive budget cuts? Here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'm Tom Temin, and we'll be right back.
By combining science, technology, and collaboration, Noblest is developing interagency solutions that lead to faster adoption of technologies. George Kibuzinski explains Noblest's leading role in establishing interoperability standards for automated fingerprint identification systems.
Our work started out in response to the National Academy of Sciences report. This report identified the lack of interoperability between automated fingerprint identification systems as a significant problem. The solution, called the Extended Feature Set, was then incorporated into a national standard, which is used by all major vendors, both in the United States and internationally. The implementation is going to greatly increase the number of identifications, which means we're going to get more criminals off the streets, and it will result in cost savings to agencies that operate the automated fingerprint identification systems.
Welcome back to the Noblest Insights panel. Can innovation survive budget cuts? Here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'm Tom Temin. Our panelists today are Jim Zarzycki, a Noblest Fellow, Dr. Daniel Gerstein, Deputy Undersecretary of the DHS Science and Technology Directorate, Dr. Timothy Persons, Chief Scientist at GAO, and Daniel Madrikowski, program leader at the Engineering Laboratory at NIST. And some of the higher tech areas that might be longer in payoff for first response and emergency involve ChemBio and network security. Dr. Gerstein, tell us some of the activities you're launching in science and technology in those more difficult areas.
Well, thanks, Tom. In fact, at Science and Technology, we have three overarching priority areas, and they are homemade explosives, cyber, and bio. And bio is a particularly difficult issue, and we're working very hard on that. We have a number of programs ongoing. Some of them are across the department. Others are within S&T. For example, we're working on developing a real-time point-of-care diagnostics capability. It would fundamentally change the way we do healthcare in this country. We're also looking at forensics and attribution. Our National Bioanalysis Countermeasure Center, in fact, just received its certification to operate in a biological safety level 4, which is the highest containment level, and they will be operational as of the 18th of November, which is a real major accomplishment. And then the foot and mouth disease vaccine might not be known to the audience, but 10% of exports are agricultural, and that would certainly be something that we would want to have. So those are just a couple of things we're doing. In the cyber field, we have a product very low cost to develop, but in fact had a huge impact. We created something called the Domain Name Server Security, DNSSEC, which has been responsible for being implemented and, in fact, just won a recent award. So there's a lot going on high tech, and it will have direct abilities to impact on our security.
And Jim Zarzycki, what are you seeing across government in some of these higher tech areas? I think you've looked at network security, for example.
We have looked at network security, and what we're finding is as you get into these complex technical areas like network security and biosurveillance, you tend to have large amounts of data, which is actually valuable because today we can process large amounts of data with the computing power that we have. And a cost-effective way to work some of these technologies is actually through models. And that's something that I think we will have to, as a nation, rely more upon as we go forward, as we see shrinking budgets. We're going to have to use the models more effectively, productively, to address the problem. So as an example, Nobilis has done a good amount of work for the Department of Homeland Security, the Cybersecurity and Communications Directorate. And one of the things we've worked on is their emergency system for contacting people. And so you can model the entire communications network and help you find vulnerabilities and help you ensure that you can make a communication to the critical people that you need to communicate with during an emergency. The other area that I think is very important these days is the whole area of informatics and particularly bioinformatics. So being able to use these vast data sets coming from disparate sources and be able to determine the identification of the biological agent, the pathogen, whether it's a biological warfare agent or just a disease, an infectious disease, and then be able to go right to how you might attack that from a standpoint of coming up with the medical countermeasure.
And Tim Persons, what is the danger then when we try to translate all this into operational products and contracts, again, given the budget constraints that all of government is operating under?
Well, the danger, of course, for example, in the modeling simulation domain is again, doing sufficient testing and evaluation in that so that that comports with reality. That's always the core challenge there. Does your model exhibit the real world? And that's where a lot of times science and technology and things, when you're doing something in a lab, but oftentimes when you throw it up against a real operational context and the, quote, real world, it can fail or in some cases fail spectacularly. But
sure. And Dan Madrikowski, do you follow at NIST what happens as things that are experimental and standards based then become into the marketplace? Do you follow up and see how they did and were they in fact productized?
To a certain degree. Whenever we do an investigation, for example, like the World Trade Center, and we have recommendations on what should be changed to make things better, we try to track those and see how many of them have gotten into building codes or standards or things of that nature. With regard to some of the chemical measurements and chemistry, how to get things that are workable, engineers at NIST recently developed a system for detecting trace amounts of explosives off of people's shoes. And the idea there is so that when you go through the TSA checkpoint someday, you won't have to take your shoes off. But we'll still get a very reliable and measurement of whether or not there's a threat. Instrument standards for any of these detection things, chemical vapors, biotech things, how well does the instrument work? You need to follow up. And then you want to accreditate a lab. So we have systems for accrediting labs to check radiation or chemical standards to make sure that as the manufacturers are producing these things, they're actually developing something that is going to work, that we can reliably count on to work, that's measured against a standard.
And Dr. Persons, there is the issue of organizational conflict of interest, which agencies are sensitive to. And so if someone does the basic research under a federal grant, is it possible for the same knowledge-based company or entity or academic, whatever it might be, to go ahead and then turn that into a product, or does it have to be somebody else?
Well, there is a sense of there's the idea of intellectual property that allows you to sort of leverage market forces and create incentives for people to try and transition things out of a basic research concept into an applied and so on. I think there are, of course, scenarios where it's rife for conflicts of interest, especially when you're dealing with a lot of times very high technology areas, oftentimes a very small ecosystems, as you will, of people doing it. So it can present itself. But again, in terms of incorporating high tech or innovative things into a new paradigm, a new CONOPS, a new system, having an independent testing and evaluation, having the measurements, as Dan has been saying, is critical in this.
And Dr. Gerstein, so now you've outlined both sides for us, some really tough constraints and some areas that DHS is not investing in at the moment, and also some really exciting areas. Give us your overall assessment of where science and technology is headed and what we can expect in the near term that would be helpful to this whole first response, emergency, and homeland security area.
Well, let me say that I do believe that science and technology is an integral part of what must occur if we are to maintain the homeland security enterprise. It's absolutely critical that we continue to develop in key areas. Now, there are some areas that are going to be more important than others. There are some where we can work with others, as we've talked about, such as other departments and agencies, such as international partners, such as industry, and that's all very healthy. But we do have to understand that there are some areas that are at risk in this budget pressures. And one, for example, that I would highlight is our National Biological Agricultural Facility, the MBAF. We were planning to build an agricultural system that would give us a BSL-4 capability. And, for example, that is currently at risk given the current fiscal environment. So we're very concerned that we make the right decisions with regard to the fiscal pressures.
And Jim Zarzycki, I imagine one way to make sure that agencies get the most out of the dollars they have for research and development is to not chase things that don't have much chance of succeeding, because that happens in science and technology. Are there markers and indicators that you have learned along the way working with so many agencies that it's possible to identify what might be something to leave and go on to something more promising?
Well, I think we go back to the requirements. You have to really look at the needs of your user community. But I think today what we want to do is not take a salami slice approach to things. I think I look at things at glass half full. There's a great opportunity to kind of look at where we're at, rebalance the portfolio. But I think the way to do that is not by cutting every program 10% or 20%. I think Dan's in a position where, from what he said, he's taking the right approach. You've got to make some hard decisions, and in certain areas we'll have to
be cut, and others you want to make sure that you continue to invest in. And both ways, in the in that adapt-adopt approach to get something into the hands of your stakeholders quickly, but also to make sure that you preserve that science base for the long term.
And Dr. Persons?
I think there are some creative things going on that can apply in terms of innovation in this mission space. Think of all the handheld devices people have in terms of smartphones and so on. That's a social network system of sensors that could be used for first responders and so on. Think of what the Department of Defense has done over in Iraq and Afghanistan with intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, or ISR assets. What can those do in the context of a natural disaster or something to support first responders and things like that? Or as well as just you talk about fire prevention, one of the easiest ways is looking at geographic information systems. We're in the age of Google Earth and being able to look at things and trying to prevent or look and predict at areas that are at most at risk out in the West or in Florida on the West Coast, those sort of things.
Lots to think about. You've been listening to the Nobilis Insights panel, Can Innovation Survive Budget Cuts? Our guests have been Jim Zarzycki, Nobilis Fellow, Daniel Matrikowski, Program Leader at the Engineering Laboratory at NIST, Dr. Timothy Persons, Chief Scientist at GAO, and Dr. Daniel Gerstein, Deputy Undersecretary of the DHS Science and Technology Directorate. I'm Tom Temin, and this is Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
If you missed any portion of this show, you can listen to it in its entirety and on demand at federalnewsradio.com. And if you'd like more information, please go to noblis.org.
Nobilis's approach to modeling and simulation uses customer data to produce real-world outcomes and deploy technologies faster. Mike Yablonsky discusses how Nobilis's simulations are reducing flight delays and creating cost savings for the federal government.
Nobilis is currently building detailed airport surface simulations to assess the benefits of deploying data communications digital air traffic clearances for aircraft reroutes during severe weather events. These simulations are constructed and calibrated using Federal Aviation Administration operational data in collaboration with air traffic experts at various facilities throughout the United States. The value we deliver to our stakeholders consists of system operational impacts from the deployment of new technologies, resulting in delay reduction and cost savings.